fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
The history of mathematics, in many ways, begins with counting. Things that needed initially to be counted were, and often still are, just that, things. We can say that we have 12 tomatoes, or 5 friends, or that 11 days have passed. As society got more complex, tools that have been used since time immemorial, such as string and scales, became essential tools for counting not only concrete things, like sheep and bison, but more abstract things, such as distance and weight, based on agreed-upon multiples of physical artifacts that were copied. This development could not have taken place without the idea of a unit, a standard of measuring something that defines what it means to have one of something. These units can be treated not only as counting numbers, but can be manipulated using fractions and divided into arbitrarily small pieces. They can even be multiplied and divided together to form new units. So where does the idea of a unit come from? What's the difference between a unit, a dimension, and a variable? And how does the idea of physical dimension allow us to simplify complex problems? All this and more on this episode of Breaking Math. Episode 80, Physical Dimension. I'm Sophia, and you're listening to Breaking Math. With me, I have on the host and co-host of Nerd Forensics. I have Millicent Oriana.
Hey, how you doing?
And I'm sorry.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
Yeah, I bumped Millie's microphone. And how are you doing, Jacob Urban?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm here. Let's get to the math.
So let me ask both of you, name a unit or a dimension, a physical dimension.
Hogshead.
A hogshead, yeah, which is, I believe, 31 gallons or 62.
Something like that. Like, it's a lot. I know that.
63 gallons.
That's why it's really funny, The Simpsons, when Grandpa says, I get 3 rods to the hogshead.
Yeah.
Because it's like... That car burns like 60 gallons to move like 10 feet.
And actually, let's convert that. So here's the thing, and that's the thing that's cool. You know, rods to the hogshead, it's in units of what? A rod is distance, right?
Yes.
Or length, whatever you want to call that. Often in the literature, that's referred to as length, not distance. And a hogshead is a measure of what?
Liquid.
Specifically a measure of volume.
Yeah, volume.
Because you can have a hogshead of air or a hogshead of...
Hogsheads.
Yeah, yes, you could. A hogshead of hogsheads. It would, yeah. Let's never speak of the hogshead of hogshead. But you can convert this into miles per gallon because a mile is also a length. I mean, and a gallon is a volume measurement. So 40 rods of the hogshead.
Oh, 40 rods of the hogshead.
Which is, let's see.
You said 63. Yeah,
yeah, okay. So if we know that it's 40 rods to the hogshead, it's going to be less miles per hogshead, right?
Yeah. Well, it depends, actually, because it says here a hogshead of wine is 63 gallons while a hogshead of beer is 54.
Oh, yeah, but I'm just saying, let's assume for the problem 63. That it's 63. Yeah. What's your intuition? If 40 rods to the hogshead, would that be fewer miles to the hogshead or more miles to the hogshead?
Fewer.
Yeah, it's much far fewer. Right?
Oh, yeah, so then what we're going to do is we're going to divide by 320. So now we're left with hogsheads and gallons. So if I have a certain number of, distance per gallon per hogshead, am I going to be able to go a further distance or less distance with a gallon?
Less.
Yeah, right? So
way
if we,
less.
Yeah, exactly. So if we take that and we divide that further by the number of gallons in a hogshead. So it's 40 divided by 320 divided by 63, which gets us 0.00198 miles per gallon. Which is equal to about 504 gallons per mile. Now, let's say you wanted to convert this into feet per gallon. How would you do that? Remember, this is miles per gallon. So how do we do feet per gallon?
You divide it again.
Well, would it be fewer feet per gallon or more feet per gallon?
Oh,
well,
sorry, more.
Yeah,
more.
We got to be careful with these.
Yeah.
So we multiply that by 5,280, which means it's 10 feet per gallon.
Oh, my God.
That gives us an idea of how we manipulate these numbers. You know, as we're using multiplication, division, we're kind of seeing, like, you know, when we went from a large unit, the hogshead, to a smaller unit, the gallon, it decreased the thing that we were dealing with, right?
Yeah.
But only because it was the reciprocal. We were dividing by gallons, right?
Yes.
So we're gonna talk about, like, you know, why this is on this episode, basically. Jacob, you were on the episode about counting. So what can you tell us just briefly about counting?
It's basically a way to organize, like, a system of units.
Yeah, knowing if you have more one thing than another.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that the history of measurement in early times, like, you know, length, you have to measure length for certain things, right? If you're making a drill, for example, you're going to want the shell to have kind of the same curvature as the end of the piece of wood that you have, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In one of those kind of bow drills. You're going to need to measure things all the time. You're going to need to, do weight intuitively. Like, if somebody, like, you know, like, this fish is bigger than that fish. So we use our bodies is like, that was our first way of measuring length. I mean, it was just our bodies, our eyes, things like that, you know. Time, actually, was kind of the last thing to be measured accurately, because it requires a clock to be measured accurately. It wasn't really measured accurately until Greek times, where water clocks were used for court cases, which was standardized in Roman times. Have either of you heard of this?
No,
that's interesting.
It was a conical vessel so that the pressure would be equal the whole time. And a court had, like, certain parts of the court had to last certain amounts of time on this water clock. So the way that mass started being measured is a balance scale is one of the simplest devices you can do. You just need something rigid and two things that you can hang from it that are the same.
Like a teeter-totter.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like a teeter-totter with two things hanging from it. So the Egyptians, they used what was called a deben as a standard weight in Egypt. And it was first used to kind of measure gold. One early mention of the deben talks about, it's on the juridical stela from the reign of Neferirwa I. He had a debt of 60 gold deben, and so he gave up his governorship of El Kab, early example of buying a government office. And then in 19th dynasty, a slave girl priced 4 deben and 1 kite of silver was paid for with 6 bronze vessels, 10 deben of copper, 15 linen garments, a shroud, a blanket, and a pot of honey. So it's interesting, basically, to get all from all this, weight was necessary at first to measure things having to do with money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you have, like, you know, the idea of a stone, which was used to measure, like, weights, and it was originally 14-pound stone, which was standardized. That is to say that all these different ways of measuring things became more and more standardized. You had the cubit, which was the length between an elbow and the tip of the middle finger.
Yeah.
The king's cubit was interesting is that they added another hand to it, another 4 inches, because, you know, the king has to have big arms.
Yes. Yeah, because he's important. Look at how long my arms are.
Yes, we were talking about you, Noxy. That's why.
Yeah, Noxy has a king's cubit.
Yeah, the cat is meowing.
Yeah.
And the Chinese actually used a type of clock called an incense clock as well, where powdered incense was put on kind of a spiral thing around.
Interesting.
Yeah, and what was cool about it, too, is that if it was used for, if it had different periods of stuff, they could use different types of incense for different periods of time, which, you know, I think is pretty cool, actually. I kind of wish I had that.
Yeah, they would, like, burn at different
so, like, different speed. Types of, like, resins.
Yeah, depending on.
Let me clarify, actually, what I mean. What I mean is, like, let's say you had, you know, 1 cent, for the first 2 hours, and then another scent for the last 3 hours. So then, when you smell
the scent changing,
you know that the time has reached that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's a cool little thing.
Yeah, and this kind of, you know, this continued for a while. Essentially, you have all these units being standardized over time. Eventually, getting to the point where you're standardizing other things. So not just immediate things that you could measure, such as, you know, with your eyes, such as, like, you know, volume, you know, which is a cube of length. You have length times length is volume, or which is a derived unit, obviously, from length. Or weight, but now you're measuring things such as temperature. Temperature was originally thought in like the 1500s to be something that you couldn't really measure because it was so subjective. People pointed to the idea of dry colds versus like wet colds and stuff like that. But it turns out that Newton and Romer figured that out in the early 1700s.
Oh.
The way that you measure temperature is by seeing how much your thermometric material like changes volume.
Some sort of thermometer.
Some kind of thermometer for measuring thermos. Thermo being Greek for heat. But yeah, so this is a Newton scale, zero being the heat of air in winter at which water begins to freeze. And then he called these degrees of heat. So then 40 of degrees, you have melting point of an alloy of one part lead, four parts tin, and five parts bismuth, and so on. And then Romer's system was a little bit refined based past that, because it's based on the freezing point of water being 7.5 degrees and the boiling point being 60 degrees.
Interesting.
It might seem a little bit weird, but 7.5 is 60 divided by 8.
Yeah.
So it does make some kind of sense, especially because this was before decimals were used all the time in science.
Okay.
And then you have metrification in the 1600s through the 1800s. And we've gotten to the point now where none of the... originally, a kilogram was this platinum weight called the kilogram. You had, and the meter was two scratches on a... I think it was like a gold pole. Yeah. And it sounds funny, but you have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's just really funny that it's just like, let's put some scratches on a pole and that'll be the length we need. Yeah.
This is it.
And it was originally defined as 1/10,000th of the equator.
Interesting.
But now it is defined exactly as the how quickly light travels. And 1/299,792,456 of a second. And a second is defined as taking the fixed numerical value of the cesium frequency, the unperturbed ground state hyperfine transitions frequency of the cesium 133 atom to be exactly 7,192,631,770 hertz. That is to say that now all of our metric units are based on things you can find anywhere in the universe, which I think is pretty cool.
I think we should just go back to using, like, a king as, like, the determination. Like, yeah, this is the size of Philip's nose.
No, we should just use King Philip as all lengths of measurement.
Let's dig up King Philip. All right, so now we got derived units. So let me just kind of go through a few of these right here with you. Do you know what the difference between a dimension and a unit is?
Dimension is going to be like the size of something.
You'd think so, but turns out that dimensions actually just talks about what unit is being measured, what unit you need. But the unit talks about the specific unit. So, for example, a foot and a meter are both used to measure length, and length is given the symbol L for dimensions. So they would still use the same dimension. I mean, you can even use rods, you can use miles, you can use
meters.
You can use smoots.
Smoot, really? Mm-hmm. That's an actual word.
Yeah, smoot was it was measured by there's this guy, what is his name? Oliver R. Smoot, who laid down repeatedly on the Harvard Bridge between Boston and Cambridge so his fraternity brothers could use his height to measure the length of the bridge. And they defined one smoot, the bridge length to be measured to be exactly 364.4 smoots.
See, that's the type of measurement systems we need.
I agree.
Yeah, so, yeah, like you said, length can be foot, smoots. Let's see, we also have... So here we have velocity. Here, L, T to the negative 1. What that means is L divided by T. Is that clear?
Yes.
Yes.
And what that means is length over time.
Yeah.
It makes sense, right? Miles per hour, meters per second, feet per second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have acceleration, feet per second, or miles per hour per second, meters per second, whatever, and so on. But the idea is that you have these certain base dimensions that you can divide all these other dimensions into, right?
Yeah.
So, exactly. So, I mean, even temperature, which is a base dimension, that's actually an interesting thing to bring up. Temperature itself describes the average energy of something, which would, you'd think would be mass times length squared over time squared, right? You'd think that since temperature can be reduced to that, you'd be able to change the units, right, and get that even to a more base unit.
Yeah.
But it turns out that it's about the macroscopic view of the system. So if temperature is not, if we're not dealing with the actual energy of the particles, we can treat temperature as an abstract quantity. And the same thing goes for example, mass and energy. There's a mass energy equivalence, but we're not going to use it in every problem. There's also an equivalence between time and space. You know, in most problems, we don't use that equivalence, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah, because I mean, we don't talk about, like, you know, I'm gonna. For example, Jacob, you're about 6 feet away from me, right?
Yeah.
Which means that you're about 6 nanoseconds away from me in light terms.
Yeah.
So and I'll list the sources at the end of this episode. But one of the sources I was reading talked about how in fluid mechanics, the primary or fundamental dimensions are mass, length, time, and temperature. Which means that everything can be broken into these four things. In other areas of physics, you might even have luminous intensity, amount of substance or electric current be base units.
Okay.
But the important thing is that you can't add a foot to a pound, right?
No.
You can multiply them. You can have a foot pound, but you can't add them. And that's the first thing that we're going to talk about is the idea of commeasurability. When we're talking about physical quantities, we have to be able to compare them in some way, right? Physically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's easy to say we could add things together, but adding lengths together is different than adding weights together, right?
Yeah.
Like, just physically, like, so...
They're different things, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give you, Millie, these two pencils, and I want you to express the sum of their lengths by just moving around in space. How would you add their lengths together?
Just stack them one on the other.
Yeah, right? How would you weigh the pencils against each other?
I'd hold my hands like this, and I'd just pretty much use the weight against them.
Yeah, and if you wanted to add them together, you could put them both in one spot, right?
Yeah, I'd put them both in one hand.
Oh, yeah, so if we did a balance scale, we could weigh, like, you know, two pencils against a third that weighed as much as both of them combined, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If there's, like, a heavier pencil, yeah, I could, you know, two of these and one of those.
Yeah, so that's how you'd show equality is by using a scale, right? If two weights are equal, then they will be level on the scale.
Yeah.
But if two lengths are equal, then they will match up geometrically, right?
Yes. Yeah, they'll both compare to one another.
Yeah, and so that means that we have a few rules. So the comparison operation, equality, must obey the identity law. So if two lengths are equal to each other, and the second one is equal to a third one, then the first and the third are the same length, right?
Yeah.
Or mass, or whatever unit, right?
Yeah, whatever we're adding.
Whatever you're measuring, yeah.
Yeah, and also it has to not matter what order we add things in. So A plus B plus C has to be the same as B plus A plus C. These seem like, you know, self-explanatory things, but there are certain things that don't act this way. For example, matrices, when you multiply them together, there's certain operations that just don't work that way. And then finally, if you add things together a certain number of times, so if you add it together three times, you have to be able to divide that back out. So those are the rules for a physical dimension. So so now we have, like, so E equals MC squared is a famous equation, right?
Yes.
F equals MA. All, what's interesting about any physical formula, no matter what, the units have to be the same on both sides, no matter what. It sounds like something that you could take for granted, but if you actually analyze this fact about physical quantities, you get some pretty deep stuff. So Joseph Fourier, he introduced the concept of physical dimension in his 1822 book, Théorie analytique de la calure, or that.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.
Analytical theory of heat. This is the first time that physical dimension was mentioned in any text, and this is the table from his book. We have X, which is one of the variables, being dimension 1 of length, 0 of duration, and 0 of temperature, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We have specific conductivity, surface conductibility, capacity for heat, etc. So this is a way that, so what's interesting is that by breaking down, by listing all of our different factors that we have in a problem, and breaking them down, there's actually a way that we could significantly simplify most problems. So that brings us to... So we're going to talk about the Buckingham Pi theorem. So it says that any physically meaningful equation with n variables can be rewritten as n minus k dimensionless parameters, where k is a number of independent dimensions. So what does that mean? So what that means is that any physical thing, so like, let's say we get the period of a pendulum, right? Yeah. Or like, you know, the height of a splash in liquid. Any formula that takes in a bunch of dimensions, like height, heat, whatever, and spits something else out, whether it be a frequency, a weight, a force, you can always express it as in dimensionless parameters. And dimensionless parameters are the parameters combined together. So let's explore what that means. And a pendulum is swinging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's assume that there's no air, nothing like that. We don't care about the friction of the string, anything like that. We just have a pendulum swinging. Do you know anything about the period of a pendulum, either of you? What's it dependent on?
It's the gear itself. The gear has to turn it, right?
Oh, well, not a clock pendulum per se, just like a swinging ball on a...
Yeah.
On a...
It's, isn't it something about the leverage or...
Well, we'll figure it out. Let's pretend.
It will always, like, it will have to eventually, the swinging will have to go down.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but that's only continuing on friction. We're talking about an ideal pendulum that swings forever. So what we're going to talk about is, let's say we want to know how long the pendulum takes to swing back and forth, right? The period.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is that measured in?
Seconds.
Time.
The exact, both of you are right. The unit is seconds and the dimension is time. So let's think about certain things that might be able to affect a pendulum swing. The length of the string, obviously, right?
Yeah.
So let's write these down. So the length of the string, so we're trying to get the period in seconds. We have the length of the string. What else can we, what
the
other?
Weight. The weight, yeah, the weight
of the
pendulum.
Of the string.
Well, and of the
pendulum.
Of the pendulum itself at the end.
Oh, that's what I mean. So not the string, yeah, the pendulum. We're assuming the string is massless. So the mass is going to be measured in kilograms. It's going to be mass. Length is going to be measured in meters, and it's going to be L for length. Period is measured in seconds. It's measured in time. Let's see what else. We have obviously how much gravity there is on Earth, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's. So we have G, which is measured in meters per second squared, which is length times time to the negative 2. Anything else that we could think of that might affect this problem?
I mean, since we're taking out things like air and of that nature, like we're focused on just the pendulum itself, I think that might be it.
Yeah, I think we're good.
All right, so let's take a look at this. The Buckingham Pi theorem, so we have how many variables here?
Four.
Four variables, right? Period, length, mass, and G, where G is pretty much the same everywhere on Earth, we're assuming. That gives us four variables. Now, how many base dimensions do we have here?
One, two.
We have time, we have length.
We have mass.
We have mass.
And we have...
This is just a combination of length and time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So I would say three units.
All right, yeah. So the Buckingham Pi theorem says that we could combine this into a few, into only one unitless thing, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, so we have a period as being a function of mass, length, and G, right? Because we're trying to figure out the formula for period, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Do you notice that period, length, and G, none of those have a kilogram in them?
Yeah.
The weight is the only thing with a kilogram in it.
Yeah.
Time appears both in period and G. Length appears in both in G and you know, the length of a string itself. But the mass, if we're doing any kind of unitless thing, this has to be zero, right? We can't have mass be part of the thing because we can multiply G by the period squared and get a different quantity. We can multiply G by the, divide G by the length and get something without units. But the kilogram, there's nothing else in the problem with the kilogram.
Yeah.
So what is that? What might that tell you?
We don't need it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Turns out that the mass of the thing in the pendulum does not matter. And what's fascinating is that we got to that with dimensional analysis, not by scientific measurement, right?
Yeah.
And that's the power of dimensional analysis, really, is that, you know, you can simplify these problems to much, much simpler problems. All right, so we're trying to get period out of length and G right now.
Yes.
So we need a second out of a length and g, which is length per second squared, right? So if we take length and divide it by g, we're left with seconds squared, right?
Yes.
And obviously we would have to take the square root of that because we need to get back to regular seconds, right?
Yeah.
And what's that? That's actually one of the things interesting about dimensional analysis is that you always need, unless you're doing some weird fractal stuff, which I don't know how to do, but that honestly sounds like something I should look into. You're going to want a whole number or at least a rational number of fractions, because basically you just have to always get the dimensions to match up. And as soon as you get the dimensions to match up, you know what affects what. So now we're going to do a problem together for the Buckingham Pi theorem. And how about we do the problem of, let's say you throw an object into a liquid, how high does it splash? Do you want to do that problem?
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
That
sounds great.
All right. So let's say we have a few things that matter. Let's say the radius of the object, right? So we have the radius of the object. That must matter, right? Because if something is 10 times the radius, it can cause a different splash, right?
Yeah.
The mass of the object, we say the velocity of the object, the density of the medium, the viscosity of the medium, and the height of the splash.
Yeah.
So it turns out that the way that you make dimensionless quantities out of that is if we take the viscosity multiplied by the radius squared, divided by the velocity, and divided by the mass of the object, you get a dimensionless quantity. If you take the density of the medium multiplied by the radius cubed and divided by the mass, you get another dimensionless quantity. And then finally, the height of the splash divided by the radius of the object is another dimensionless quantity. So what we get here is this formula. H over R is some function of these two independent quantities, WR squared over VM and PR cubed over M. You know, it might seem like we're just reordering variables around, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that this actually tells us some fundamental truths about the problem. So, for example, since it's a function of these two variables, right? If this stays constant, and while this stays constant, this is not going to change, right? Nothing else.
No.
Here, if we make the medium twice as viscous, we'd have to have twice the mass to have the same splash.
Yeah.
And that tracks, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Now we could actually redo the problem with a completely different set of dimensions. Radius of the object, density of the object this time, right? So this time, because now the radius and mass would get, assuming a spherical thing. So radius and mass would give us the density, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But now we're just treating the density as a separate quantity itself, and we've got rid of mass as a quantity.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this actually simplifies our problem slightly, you see?
Yeah.
Yes.
And it turns out that it's a function of the ratio between the viscosity, between the density of the medium and the density of the object. As long as that stays constant, the problem, splash will stay the same height.
Yeah, it should stay the same exact height.
No, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. And notice this could be any formula with these two things. So, I mean, it could be as complex as we want because, the sine of something tells you, goes from an angle to basically how far something is from the center of the circle sideways, right? I mean, not the sine, the cosine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't take the cosine of a meter because the cosine formula is, if you break it down, okay, so like x plus minus x cubed divided by 3 factorial plus x to the fifth divided by 5 factorial minus. So you have all these different powers and we can't add like a kilogram to a kilogram cubed to a kilogram to the fifth, right?
No.
And that's why when we're actually dealing with physical quantities, we can only really add, divide, square, take square roots, you know, do that thing, algebraic things. And what's interesting here that I wanted to bring to your attention.
Oh, yeah. You're revising the formula and making it more simplistic.
This is how the variables shook out with the new set of variables. That's the new, mm-hmm. it shakes out differently. So you simplify the formula by sometimes, you know, trying different sets of variables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you get something that doesn't make sense, that's usually physics' way of telling you, you forgot a variable.
Yeah.
You forgot something that matters. And that's another huge, huge benefit of using dimensional analysis.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you sit there going, this doesn't make sense. That's not right.
If it doesn't add up, then you know something's wrong.
Yeah. And exactly, yeah. And the Buckingham Pi theorem, the way that you get these new variables, is actually the rank of the dimension matrix. So remember earlier I was showing you that list of numbers from that paper?
Yes.
Yeah.
It turns out that if you treat this like a matrix and you see how many linearly independent factors it has, that turns out to be the number of dimensionless quantities that you can have. Oh yeah, and I was also gonna say that the base quantities. So let's say we have a problem where we have something. One of the variables is force, which can be broken down into kilograms times meters per second squared, and the other variables of importance are, let's say one of them is mass and one of them is acceleration. Right, F equals ma. Okay, let's just use that. The base units of that formula aren't, there's not three base units. You might think that there are because of kilograms, meters, and seconds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it turns out that because on one side you have kilogram times meters per second squared, and on the other side you have kilograms and meters per second squared. So the fact that you can't really break these down further, like I can't get a second out of this, right?
Yeah.
No. Like I can't divide these units to get a second. And that's basically the definition of a base unit in any problem. It's not about the actual meters and seconds. Those can help us find it, but it's about how many actual physically independent things are there, whether that be force or even a more derived quantity, you know, like moment of area or something weird.
Yeah.
This is a really, really useful thing. Millie, were you on the episode about back of the envelope estimations? No, I think that wasn't you. But yeah, this can be used with back of the envelope estimations. So like if I reduce the problem into a bunch of simpler problems, I can do stuff like play with balloons in the sink and be like, oh, okay, that's how a submarine might work or something like that.
Yeah.
It allows us to really... So if we have six different variables and we need to kind of like test the different numerical quantities that matter, we're hit with the curse of dimensionality, which means that, let's say if you just wanted to have 10 samples in each direction, you get 10 times 10 times 10 to like six times, which is a million different samples. But if you could reduce it to two dimensionless quantities, the number of samples that you need to really get a good idea of how the problem works goes down to 100.
Okay. Oh,
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it just makes things simpler.
Exactly,
and easier
yeah.
to work. Like, it makes these big, gigantic, like, problems simpler and easier to work on.
Oh, yeah, exactly, yeah. And the problem in one of the books that I'm referencing, I'll give the name at the end of the episode, it talks about the problem of throwing a ball against a wall and how much, and if the ball's covered in ink, how big is the spot on the ball compared to the ball itself?
Yeah.
The spot on the wall, I mean, that from the ink.
Yeah, the splash and all that.
Yeah, and as you can see here, he takes all these different variables, E, rho, whatever, and reduces it to two variables, and you can see how they behave in terms of one another.
It'd be great to live in, like, the 1700s and just dip a ball in ink and throw it at a wall and say I'm a mathematician.
No, this is more recent stuff. Yeah. This is actually, it's the utility.
1800s.
Okay, it goes back to the 1600s, but the utility of this stuff really got big and, like you know, people like Feynman during like the atomic bomb, they used to do this thing where you had 10 seconds to give somebody a math problem. They had 10 seconds to answer it with one digit of accuracy.
Yeah.
Which is 10, you know, 10 different numbers. So you just little like exercises like that and kind of just our full understanding of units and just kind of like our fuller understanding of mathematics in the 20th century really led to this coming into like, you know, this is big stuff now comparatively.
Yeah.
I mean, one interesting thing about Oppenheimer is that when the atomic bomb went off, he dropped a handful of paper. The paper shards blew away, and he was able to calculate the approximate megatonnage of the bomb within a few seconds before all the calculations were given.
Wow. Yeah, just by looking at the paper blowing.
Yeah, he saw how far the paper blew.
Yeah.
Oh, and really quick, I'm just going to talk about the steps of the Buckingham Pi theorem. So let's say you have n relevant variables and m independent dimensions, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have these parameters that you want to talk about the relationships between. What you do is you choose m scaling variables. So like, you know, variables that represent like, you know, just like base variables. So you choose like a few of them that are linearly independent. And there's going to be a guarantee that you're going to be able to find M because it's the amount of linearly independent rows and columns, the rank of the matrix.
Yeah.
So it's guaranteed to exist. And then for each of the N minus M remaining variables, what you do is you multiply them by each of those variables. So you go through the variables and you make them unitless. And that's the procedure. That's the entire procedure to determining the pi groups is what they're called.
Okay.
Physical dimension allows us to talk about the world in terms of numbers. This was the basis of physics, since physics is just math about the world around us. We've explored how dimensions can be reduced to dimensionless quantities, and the power that this gives us to talk about seemingly hopelessly complex physical problems in straightforward terms. I'm Sophia, and this has been Breaking Math. The big source we used for this episode today was The Physical Basis of Dimensional Analysis by Ayn A. Sonnen, and the lectures by David Apsley from the University of Manchester on his website. I would give both of those a check out if I were y'all. So, Millie, Jacob, what did you think?
Well, if I ever need to know, like, the radius of, like, an ink ball splashing on a wall, I think I now have the tools I need to figure it out.
Yeah, like, if I want to know how big the splash is going to be from that artificial lake I'm going to make filled with maple syrup, and when I chuck bowling balls in it all day, I can figure out how big the splash is going to be.
And you can call yourself a physicist.
And I can call myself a physicist for doing it.
Oh, one important thing, actually, that I forgot to bring up on the main episode, but you kind of brought up here is... This only helps us in as much as we know how to measure quantities, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if we don't know the units for viscosity, talking about viscosity won't help us, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's just one of the... And another thing we didn't quite talk about is that sometimes if you include too many variables in your analysis, you get too many dimensionless quantities, and that can make the problem complex again. So it's all about, playing around with, it's all about trial and error in math and science.
We're back to the scales of trying to find a balance.
Yeah, that is a scale-related term, isn't it?
Yeah.
Trying to find a balance. Any last thoughts? I already asked that. Good night, everyone.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say, too. With RSS.com... Starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.